All right. Well, welcome everyone. Thanks for coming here today and joining us for our discussion about the past year under the Trump administration and what a year it's been, as everyone exhales collectively. We did want to take time today to talk through what the past year has meant for the landscape of immigration enforcement and detention. There's been a lot to focus on this past year in terms of immigration, and certainly most recently, a lot of attention, rightfully so, has been placed on a solution for Dreamers and what a legislative fix might look like. But in the meantime, in the background, a lot is happening on the enforcement and detention front, and we thought it important at this, you know, one-year anniversary to sort of take a moment, or an hour or two, to look back at the changes that were promised, the changes that actually happened, and what we can anticipate in the year to come. So we welcome our experts who are here today, who I'll introduce in a moment, but also we welcome your feedback. We know that everyone here has some perspective on this issue from DC or from the field, and there are we have close to 24 folks on the phone right now. So we wanted to make sure we created this space to really focus on these issues while we have an opportunity. Today being January 24th is just one day before the one-year anniversary of the executive orders that started all of these balls rolling with two executive orders on border and interior enforcement. And much attention was given to, at that time, the other executive orders, or the executive orders to the extent that they focused on, we're going to make good on campaign promises to build a wall and to ban individuals from Muslim-majority countries and to slow down the refugee process. And much of that has been caught up in litigation over the past year. And again, the enforcement mechanisms, both at the border and in the interior, have sort of rolled along. And I think personally, and I think this is a perspective shared by many, the first year of the administration was focused on a lot of these big pronouncements. And I'm concerned that this year to come is going to be, you know, now that their feet are under them, they have more political appointees and leadership positions, that this is where we can see even more changes coming. So we want to talk about that here today. So I'd like to introduce our panel, go over just a moment of housekeeping, and then we'll get rolling. I'd like to introduce Chris Rickard from the ACLU, Heather Prendergast, and you know, I think everyone, I think, knows a lot of these folks, but and their bios are certainly online. We want to focus most of our time on substance. I'm not trying to diminish anyone's accomplishments or long and respected CVs. Heather Prendergast is here, both in her capacity as a private practitioner, but also as the chair of ALAS, the American Immigration Lawyer Association, the National Liaison Committee on Enforcement Issues. And Avide Musavian is with NILC, the National Immigration Law Center. So we'll be focusing this first hour on enforcement issues, and we'll take a brief, about 10-minute bio refreshment break to replenish the brownies and fruit and beverages, and return to have an hour discussion on detention issues. So that's our lay of the land today. We, press was not invited to the convening today. If you have made it here as a member of the press, then this is on background. So if you're looking for a quote, please reach out to speakers and just communicate with them directly. Finally, we will have time for Q&A. For the folks in the room, that's very easy to do. We'll take hands. For folks on the phone, for simplicity's sake, we are not going to unmute the line, but we ask that you email your questions, and we'll be monitoring that email address and take those questions in when we do our Q&A later in the hour. That email address is policy@imcouncil.org. I-M as in Mary, M as in Mary, like immigration, at imcouncil, C-O-U-N-C-I-L.org. If you have any questions about that, please let us know. So with that, I'm going to have a seat. If folks can't see me in the back, please, I invite you to join us up front. We do want to have a bit of a conversation here today. So I mentioned, and I'll turn maybe to Chris first, I mentioned at the outset that we're on the near anniversary of the executive orders, which promised lots of things and delivered on some, and perhaps promised to deliver on others. So it would be helpful if you can talk with us about you know, what has really played out from these executive orders, maybe starting with the border, but certainly sharing, you know, what progress or damage has been done in this past year.
Great. Thank you, Royce. And thank you to AIC for convening this and putting me on the panel. I'm delighted to be here with colleagues and so much knowledge in the audience and remotely as well. I think the question is really important in terms of what the orders promised and what was implemented. Instead of going line by line with all the different details, I thought I'd try to extract some examples of types of things that have and may yet happen. And the theme that I really settled on in thinking about this is that there have been some changes in enforcement that are changes in degree. I'll refer to some numbers at a juncture in terms of CBP apprehensions, in terms of ICE arrests and deportations. And that tends to be a focus of both media and public attention in terms of comparison. But even though the Obama administration had plenty of enforcement practices that we, a lot of us, tried to change and disagreed with, there were a lot of things that are continuities in terms of the mechanisms, including how people are found, including detention, including deportation. But there are some things that the administration is doing differently in kind, and I think we're going to focus on some of the philosophy of the enforcement as well. And so the examples that I draw out of the executive order, and there are multiple executive orders, of course, that came in a flurry, but I'm focusing on the one titled, helpfully, in the AIC summary, Border Security and Immigration Enforcement Improvements. And the first example is something that hasn't happened yet, but was promised. And I think that's an important thing to look at, expedited removal. And that's something that in this building and in different coalition partners' eyes could be a very devastating change to the enforcement system. Expedited removal, in short, is removal without the opportunity to see an immigration judge. So the CBP agent, and it's usually a Border Patrol agent in the past who's doing this, can issue an administrative removal order without any opportunity to have what we see as a neutral decision maker involved. And currently, expedited removal is limited to people who can't show that they've been in the United States for more than 14 days, and it's limited to the 100-mile zone CBP enforcement area. The executive order promised to increase the time period that someone would be required to show that they've been in excess of in the United States to 2 years, and says that it could be nationwide. Now, that has implications for ICE enforcement, because ICE agents could become involved in this. And very tellingly, at a Georgetown conference in the fall, a very senior official at ICE said publicly he didn't want this expedited removal authority. And that's interesting bureaucratically to think of how ICE is receiving some of this. We know they're receiving much of it with great enthusiasm, but parts of the administrative structure may not have been, of course, thought out a year ago, but even contemplated by the people implementing it. The second example that I give is CBP asylum seeker treatment. And this is something that AIC is litigating with others in terms of people who aren't even able to knock at the door. They're not able to get to the port of entry to make an asylum claim. And there's phenomenal work in that complaint and in that lawsuit in bringing to light what had been happening in the Obama administration, but has worsened. We certainly had news reports and confirmed intakes of people literally after the election day being told no asylum anymore, you know, door is shut under Trump. And that's had very, of course, that's had very profound impacts in terms of access. So when you hear the rhetoric of we're enforcing the law or the handcuffs are off the enforcement, the issue is really selective law enforcement. They're not enforcing asylum law, international law protections, and we can get more into that. So that's a second example of what I would say would be a change in degree. The third is a change in degree and in kind, and we will touch on this later, especially if others want to ask questions, criminal prosecution. So the executive order promised to ramp this up. The
real implementation memo is not from DHS, but from DOJ on this. When Jeff Sessions went to Arizona in April and announced a border prosecution initiative in very aggressive, offensive language. But the idea was not just to focus on the offenses that had been prosecuted at a very high level under Obama, namely illegal entry and reentry, 8 U.S.C. 1325 and 1326, but to also increase prosecutions of other federal immigration-related offenses, whether they be document offenses, harboring, which has been in the news this week in terms of prosecution of a No More Deaths humanitarian assistance provider. And Sessions' memo was very clear in how this was to be implemented. Of course, there are numerical goals on it that we know the Department of Justice is holding each U.S. Attorney's office to account about. But he also designated in each of these offices, and usually these offenses are focused on at the border because of initiatives like Operation Streamline and other prosecutions of people apprehended at the border. But now every single U.S. Attorney's district has a border prosecutions coordinator whose role is to ramp up criminal prosecutions of immigrants. And so I think that's a real change in terms of approach. We know that these different tracks, I started with expedited removal, a track that avoids the immigration judge system. We're going to hear more about the IJs and issues that have come up in that system. But the third track, which may not get as much attention in the administrative realm because it's a completely different Article 3 federal criminal process, is these border prosecutions. And Royce, I'll come back to the numbers maybe, but that was my overview of the order.
Appreciate that. That's very helpful. I want to make sure folks in the room can hear us clearly. I know we have microphones for purposes of being recorded and for the folks on the phone, but I want to make sure folks can hear us all right. Is it much better with the microphone close? And we'll pass that around. Okay, good. So I do want to take a moment to talk about enforcement priorities. And I certainly think that is a major shift in how enforcement is taking place, certainly in the interior. I think it's a question of what the priorities are and where enforcement is taking place as a result of those changes. So Avide, can you share with folks your thoughts on the enforcement priorities and enforcement locations?
Yeah, thank you. And thanks everyone for making time to be here. It's been quite a year, so having the space to reflect on everything that's happened, what we forecasted a year ago versus what's actually materialized versus, as Chris was pointing out, what we know is to come. I think it's really important to take stock of that. I also think it's very important to remind ourselves periodically as we're fighting all these just draconian changes in the system that, you know, it won't always be like this. And so there's a really important role that we all play in documenting as much as possible what we see and to not let the shock value of it lessen over time, even as it seems to become the more normal or regular course of business for DHS and other agencies. So I think, you know, to Chris's point about, you know, some of what has happened is a change in degree or in scope. One thing I always stressed early last year when people would ask, you know, how is this different than the Obama administration? Because, for example, some of what you're talking about, it existed. You know, there were 287G agreements with localities, or there was the targeting of people who had certain types of convictions. You know, we said things like, we're targeting felons, not families, so how is it different? And I do think that the cumulative effect of who's being targeted, how they're being targeted, and where they're being targeted, in addition to the question of scale, that's the thing that we can't lose sight of. So I would say, you know, probably the most notable difference that we've seen is based on all the many successes that occurred in the later aughts and during the course of the Obama administration, with localities really standing up and saying, we want to have policies that limit the role of our law enforcement agencies in their collaboration and collusion with ICE. As a result of that, we have seen a direct retaliation. And retaliation is a theme, I think, that will exist in other parts of the conversation that we're having today. But it's no longer it's no longer a battle around, you know, ICE just wanting access to jails. And we always knew that that was a slippery slope and would be disingenuous of ICE to say that they only want to limit their enforcement activities. You know, that the line under the Obama administration was always, well, you know, if we can have some access to the jails, it prevents us from needing to go to other places, and that will scare communities even more. Some of you may have seen last fall that ICE Director Thomas Homan had spoken to a Heritage Foundation audience and conceded the point that we've always made, which is, you know, these policies that limit ICE presence in jails, they kind of give us, and us meaning ICE, like in our view, permission to go out everywhere else in the community. So we've always said that the law enforcement policies, to the extent that they're considered so-called sanctuary policies, were never obstructionist in nature. They always upheld the Constitution and the law. And so it was always disingenuous on ICE's part to suggest otherwise. So what we have seen, of course, is that ICE very much conducts enforcement activities that are designed to essentially serve as a PR role, and a PR role that is specifically meant to manufacture fear in communities. So even in some cases, if we're not seeing a lot of consistent across the board, you know, nationwide patterns, they know that in some cases that there's going to be a lot of attention and publicity, and it will sort of do the job of accomplishing attrition. And by attrition, I mean discouraging people from engaging in everyday civic activities. So many of you are familiar, for example, with the sensitive locations memo, and the fact that there have been reports over the course of the past year of ICE violating the spirit of that policy. They're very explicit that to them it does not mean that they can't conduct ICE enforcement activities on just outside of the premises of these sensitive locations. So they have it there, still memorialized as a policy, but essentially don't adhere to it. And I think what that has, you know, I'm going to put in some silver linings where I can in this conversation. So what I think has been the response is that to the extent that it feels that anywhere is fair game in ICE's view, that there is at least the response at the local and state level of a lot of communities in schools, in hospitals, a private business owner saying, we're going to try to adopt and promote policies that, even if they don't override the rights of Department of Homeland Security and federal law, that they at least kind of send a message and are a counter PR message from the community saying, we want to resist in every way possible. So I think that's heartening, but it's obviously directly in response to the fact that ICE feels that its presence can and should be felt everywhere. I mean, they want to be the monster under the bed and around the corner, and that has been very, very explicit in the messaging. And then I would also say, just you know, the something that has struck me and that we have now seen increasingly materialize is who is targeted. So there's really a complete obliteration of the concept of prosecutorial discretion, which is in fact a law enforcement tool, as much as there are other tools available to DHS, but they ignore this one tool, and that's very significant. Obviously, the stark example of rescinding the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program is a very extreme case of that. But on an individual level, I think the fact that you have people who there have been examples of ICE enforcement activities as a result of someone showing up for a USCIS appointment for adjustment of status, you know, people going into increased apprehensions in courthouses. All of this is, you know, again, allegedly ICE saying it's safer and easier for them to do this. People going into check-ins, all of that has really just increased. And again, I will go back to the point that I don't want to suggest that these things were never happening before this administration, but it is really by design to both do more of it and also publicize when they're doing more of it. In some cases, there's it's very challenging to fight tactics when there's a measure of shamelessness that is sort of the undercurrent of the administration. And I think one thing that I was saying earlier that struck me is I remember last spring reading an article in the Washington Post that quoted an unnamed ICE official who said, you know, under the Obama administration, it was always prosecutorial discretion by press conference, essentially saying, you know, as long as you could get publicity, that would sort of be the court of public opinion would somehow hold the line in certain cases that were, you know, going to catch the attention of the public, and it could change the course of DHS's decision-making process or an immigration judge's decision-making process. And now, again, I think retaliation is very explicitly embraced as a law enforcement tactic and tool. So you couple that with shamelessness and it becomes a very, very different landscape that we're talking about. And many of you, I know, work closely with lawyers on individual cases or with community organizers on individual cases. I think that is such an important and necessary model to build over the long term. But it is obviously not a model that we can replicate to scale in a system that is, again, really bent on engaging in enforcement as by retaliating against people. So now we're in a climate where I think it makes it very challenging for people to know, am I putting more of a bullseye on my case by speaking out? And there's been more recently a number of examples of individuals who've been targeted specifically because of their longstanding activism in the community and organizing. You know, it used to be that if you had your city council member, your member of Congress speak out at a press conference, that was a good thing. That really showed that you were a part of the fabric of the community. And now I think that is, you know, that there are individuals who are being targeted specifically to be made examples of. So whether it's where ICE is going or who ICE is going after, I think that they really view this as an opportunity to just continue to generate and manufacture more fear.
Thank you, Abideh. So you raised a lot of issues that I'd like to follow up on. And I guess the first one I would start with, you mentioned discretion and the change of the use of discretion. And so I want to turn to Heather. You know, in your work as a private practitioner, but also in the, you know, the lens of, you know, being familiar with what other, you know, ALA members, private practitioners doing removal defense around the country see, can you speak to this issue of the change of how discretion is being used, whether it be in the context of stays of removal or administrative closure, recalendering, those sorts of issues, what shifts you're seeing?
Well, thank you for including me, but I will say, I'm going to start with what ICE will say, and what they say is that prosecutorial discretion has always been and continues to be a key part of immigration enforcement and what they're doing in the immigration court. So ICE maintains that they are still exercising prosecutorial discretion, and I think if you get your magnifying glass out, you might find it in very small ways, but generally speaking, administrative closure is largely over. When we met with ICE in the fall, and in the materials that are sitting outside for those of you in the room, and for ALA members, you can access these on the website. You'll find the minutes, but with respect to administrative closure, what we were told is that now to administratively close a case, the chief counsel has to get buy-in from the agency that issued the notice to appear, because Office of Chief Counsel, OPLA, Office of the Principal Legal Advisor, their job is to prosecute these cases that have been put into the stream of the immigration courts, and they're going to pursue those cases. And the only way that they're going to stand in the way of pursuing that case, you know, if USCIS or CBP or whatever issuing agency put that NTA out there, the only way that they're going to close that case is with the agreement of that agency. So actually convincing chief counsel that closing a case is a good idea is a tough enough hurdle, but then reaching out to this other agency, you know, the whole thing makes the likelihood of obtaining administrative closure extremely unlikely. Not only that, we've seen cases that were administratively closed. ICE has sought to recalendar some of those. Excuse me. So the range of what they're doing has changed significantly. you know, even getting buy-in, you know, we've heard stories of trial attorneys who will say to the immigration judge off the record, I'm okay with a grant here, but I need to be on the record objecting to this, because this is apparently what people are looking for. And I would say that you're probably more likely to find discretion exercised in very quiet ways. So if you can get something done off the record, you're going to be much more successful there. In terms of stays of removals, ICE has said that they're no longer going to continue indefinite stays. And those would be the kind of stays for, you know, the father of four U.S. citizen kids who's the primary breadwinner and one of his sons has cerebral palsy, right? You know, he's here for a reason and he's working and he's caring for his child and for that reason, and he has no criminal issues. And so he's had a stay for 8 years, but now he has to go home, especially if the son can get medical treatment in the home country, right? This is the position that ICE has taken. And we see those horrible stories and many of us have those experiences where a client with no criminal issues, an old removal order, who's very much ingrained into the community, many have U.S. citizen or permanent resident immediate relatives, these individuals go in for their annual check-in and they're taken into custody by ICE and it's incredibly traumatic. It's unbelievably shocking. And when we asked ICE how can we make this kinder and gentler? Why should the mother who's shown up year after year, who's always in compliance with everything that ICE tells her, why should she have to show up and be taken into custody? How can we make this a more reasonable, humane process? And they said, contact us. They should reach out in advance and let us know that the individual is making arrangements to leave. Again, they're coming from the position that these people can't stay here any longer, that they need to go home. If they've had a stay of removal for 2, 3, 6, 8 years, then they need to make arrangements to depart. We've seen anecdotally, there are no statistics that I'm aware of that ICE puts out there on this in terms of the number of stays filed and the number of stays granted or denied. But anecdotally, we hear across the country of very high denial rates for stays. And the stays that have been granted tend to be for less than a year. And the clear implication is that you need to make plans to depart. So after meeting with ICE in the fall, my client who came to me and is one of these people with the indefinite stay, because, you know, no criminal history, has compelling ties, very involved in his community and has extraordinary community support, but none of that matters anymore, right? I told him, I said, if I file this stay, it's going to be denied and there's a chance that you'll be taken into custody. So I said, why don't we try something different? Because you're not going to get to stay here. There's no mechanism for you to obtain a legal status here at this point. Let's tell ICE that you're making arrangements to leave, but you need time to renew your passport, sell your house, sell your vehicles, figure out a medical transport to Indonesia for your mother who's she has very serious medical issues. So that's what we did. And I think that by staying on an informal track, by not filing a stay that his supervisor's going to know about and you know, everybody, you know, if Washington wants to see what happened with this stay that was filed, you know, there's nothing on the record, but we told them about this. They said, well, you know, it's going to take a few months to get your file and then you have to renew your passport. And we know that this all takes time and we're going to work with you. So whether it takes 6 months, 8 months, a year, as long as we see forward progress, we're good. My client was thrilled because he's not going to get taken into custody. He might even get a whole year here, recognizing that he will have to ultimately leave. And I think that I couldn't have gotten that result if we had filed a stay. I you know, with all the letters from the community, if we would have brought press into it, I actually think that ICE would have done a complete 180 and been real jerks about this guy. And, you know, every person's going to be different. For my client, his key goal was not to be taken into custody. So whatever I can do to keep him out of detention, but it, in this case, seemed to work better than the old method.
That's very helpful, Heather, to hear about how advocacy tactics and goals have to sort of shift in the new environment. Thank you for sharing that case. I guess I'm going to take us from the micro to the macro again, and turn back to you, Chris. You had mentioned at the outset sort of some of the, you know, big picture, you know, when Heather's case plays out, you know, many times over, what are we, you know, there are competing narratives, I think, in the media that this administration is, you know, doing more and more aggressively. And then there are other statistics saying that deportations are down or arrests are down. And so can you help explain that, where we stand in terms of figures and what it really means?
Absolutely, I'll try. And I do think the statistics need to be much more prevalent in terms of transparency. We continue to have difficulties with DHS's selective release of statistics and the way they put data out into the media, especially with certain interpretations, but don't allow the underlying materials and evidence to be scrutinized. But I do use DHS intentionally because I think Trump has come through in terms of a deportation force that has broken down some of the barriers between ICE and Border Patrol in particular, but ICE and CBP more generally. It was always a bit false to think of ICE as the deportation agency and CBP as the Border Protection Agency because of this 100-mile zone impact of Border Patrol. And we're seeing a lot more Border Patrol activity as immigration enforcement agents. Just look at the Greyhound video in Florida. That was Border Patrol. And look at the checkpoints and, you know, the enforcement activity that's going on there. Again, a matter of discretion disappearing. But the numbers and what we can make of them, they are released still in terms of components. So you get different CBP apprehension numbers and ICE arrest and deportation numbers. And I'll start with CBP. And what's interesting, I think, over the first year is a tension in the rhetoric and the spin that's given to the CBP numbers, because there's a big desire of the administration to show that they've made an impact on apprehensions by making them fewer, that the Trump policies have sent a message of deterrence and that fewer people are coming. So there's a drive to show a statistical decline. But in the political realm, it's also important for the border to seem insecure and that there are still problems, that there are still month-to-month spikes in families or unaccompanied kids, so that there can be more enforcement measures. Of course, this is a philosophy where any apprehension is seen as a porous border or a failure of immigration enforcement. But just with that context, the last fiscal year, 17 numbers of apprehensions for CBP were released at 310,000, which are down from the fiscal year 16 numbers of 415,000. Now, if you go even further back to fiscal 15, it's roughly what happened in fiscal 17. So this is not a great change over time. We definitely know from partners and, of course, media reports that the message has unfortunately caused people to stay in very perilous circumstances when otherwise they might have tried to seek safety in the United States. But I would definitely take heavy grain of salt in terms of all the change in the Trump border apprehension numbers. Two things to point out with the apprehension statistics are, even though the numbers have declined by 100,000, migrant deaths are up. And so thinking about enforcement patterns and the danger in crossing, that certainly hasn't gone down proportionately. And in fact, the suffering seems to have increased. The other thing is, in our advocacy against the additional agents that had been promised in executive orders, both for Border Patrol and for ICE. The average number of apprehensions per active Border Patrol agent now is under 2 a month. And so the idea that you would not only staff up because they're about 2,000 below what they're allowed, the 21,000, but increase it by 5,000, and of course, the idea of adding 10,000 ICE agents, completely out of the statistical realm, much less any realm of rationality or good use of resources. ICE numbers, again, a lot of spin involved, but it was incumbent on ICE, I think, to explain why, in their words, there was a slight decrease in removals in the first fiscal year of the Trump administration. And I think the December numbers, and this is actually extending the fiscal year from October to December as well, the numbers of deportations were 226,000, which is a slight decrease from the last year of the Obama administration. What they look at, though, and these are important numbers, are arrests, which they say are the highest number in 3 years, about 143,000. And that also puts pressure on other parts of the system, right? The immigration courts. It creates a ratchet in terms of wanting to change or do expedited removal. And they sent, this was a promise in the executive order as well, they sent immigration judges to the border at one point. This was a fiasco. They had nothing to do. But you can see the various efforts to systemically put more people into the system. There will be a lot of pressure, in my opinion, this year to show a big increase in numbers. And we're going to talk about methods to, unfortunately, achieve that at work sites and other things. But the other things, just to close on the ICE numbers, they say the proportion of removals from ICE arrests have increased from 27 to 36%. That's about 16,000 people. So that's the idea that the Obama numbers, even though they were extremely high, of course, millions, 3 million plus, were mainly what they considered border removals. So people apprehended either in the act of crossing or in the border zone. And ICE is trying to say that they're doing much more activity beyond the border region with these ICE arrests that are proportion of removals greater than in the Obama years. Now, this, I think, is the most important to look at. And many of you would have seen the DHS secretary's testimony in terms of being asked about enforcement priorities. You know, John Kelly, the first DHS secretary, said that there wasn't that much change, even though the priorities and prosecutorial discretion memos were gone. They were still going after, you know, the worst in their view. But if they encountered people in that process, they wouldn't ignore them. We know that that wasn't true even at the beginning, but now I think the new DHS secretary is trying to muster statistics to show that there is targeted enforcement. And how is she doing it? The 92% figure you would have heard in her testimony, and that's from the ICE statistical report from last year, 92% are what she considers priorities. But that's people with criminal convictions, many different ranges of criminal conviction. We know the classic problem in immigration law is that aggravated felonies don't need to be aggravated. They don't need to be felonies, much less serious. But a pending charge is now a priority. That goes into the 92%. Very different. An ICE fugitive, you know, that can be someone who never got notice of his or her removal order and is suddenly in the system as a fugitive. Fugitive operations are very big in the field offices now. There are people being designated and put in charge. Question whether they're the quotas that have occasionally come up in the past. But the last one, a reinstated final order. That's a process of administrative adjudication if someone has a past removal order. But Secretary Nielsen, in responding to senators' questions about how on earth some of the people, some of the cases are priorities, said that anyone with a final order of removal, regardless of time, how long ago that happened, regardless of any extenuating factor, has suddenly become part of this 92% trumpeted figure. Now, I think the 8% also should cause us a lot of concern, but those categories tell us how the agency itself is giving a report card, not only to higher ups, but to the field officers who are enforcing the law, what they're being instructed and valorized for achieving.
If I might just build on that, you know, and I think that's where a lot of the push with these, with the getting rid of the indefinite stays of removal, because again, many of these people who year after are individuals who year after year dutifully show up for their ICE appointment. They're not criminals. They do have ties to the community. ICE doesn't have to worry about, you know, showing up at a house with eight agents wearing vests or anything. These are, by all accounts, good people. But those good people are easy numbers for them because they already have removal orders. Their case is over, right? So all they have to do is get them out of the country, and that's another number to add to their list.
That's right. The problem of low-hanging fruit that makes it an easy win for them. I do want to talk about sanctuary jurisdictions or so-called sanctuary jurisdictions. And because I don't think we can have an enforcement conversation here without talking about that, given the targeting, both in messaging and in operations that the administration has done this past year. And so, Avide, if you can share with us, I think we know that, you know, a number of jurisdictions have sort of stepped up their efforts to protect immigrants or to, you know, put some protections in place to shelter their information or to limit their cooperation. But if you can talk a bit about the targeting of sanctuary jurisdictions in terms of, you know, either actual operations or funding threats, that would be very helpful.
Yeah. Yes. And I just building on the conversation we were just having, I was thinking, so for many of us who do this work at the national level and from a place of, you know, doing advocacy work, back in July of 2015, when there was the accidental fatal shooting of a young woman in California that sort of regenerated this fight and targeting of so-called sanctuary jurisdictions. And that case actually concluded a couple months ago. You know, there was so much talk then around, you know, what kinds of sanctuary policies were acceptable, which ones went too far, which ones, you know, were good models to be replicated. And I think just something that I'm hearing in the conversation today too just reminds me, it feels like in some respects there's such importance in states and localities really banding together, and I'll talk a little bit about that in the response to the threats to take away funding to so-called sanctuary jurisdictions. But I also think that there's such an importance to the policies either, you know, remaining in place as they are or even becoming fortified and not falling prey to the pressures of creating more carve-outs. We see that more and more, and particularly at a time when we have an administration that's so intent on criminalizing immigrant communities, but also communities of color, Muslim communities. You know, unfortunately, there's been a lot more pressure, I think, to sort of escalate so-called, you know, model immigrants or people who have certain backgrounds versus those that don't. And I think that's made it really challenging for us. But just kind of on the messaging, I feel like it is so important for us to really make sure that we don't help prop up a lot of these ultimately false distinctions that the administration is making. Because as Chris was saying, you know, there's a lot of looseness in the categories that are being created. And it just, it's been interesting to observe how when we as a field and a community are so starved of options for relief, how it does create sort of the risk of dangerous precedents in saying, you know, this is a person who's a good member of the community. And I think that's also reflected in the sanctuary policies. So sorry for that segue, but just seemed timely given what we were just talking about. I think that this administration, in addition to engaging in retaliatory tactics, as I mentioned before, also really enjoys just trying to wait for their bluff to be called, essentially. There's a lot that they put in the executive orders that invited a wave of legislation, a wave of litigation. I think that they are, you know, the haste and sloppiness with which all of the executive orders, both ones we're talking about today and others, were put together really reflect, I think, just a brazen attitude, and also, you know, I think grossly underestimated the willingness of states and localities that had so-called sanctuary policies to really stick together. So in essence, I saw a lot of that language threatening to take away the funding. You know, there was a lot of concern from mayors and local law enforcement saying, what does it mean? And you know, it was really important for all of us in this room and so many around the country, and particularly people who fought locally for those policies, to remind their local elected officials, like, this is an intimidation tactic. Let's not fall prey to it. And it was particularly important for larger jurisdictions to really lead the charge in bringing a lot of those lawsuits to bring cover to the hundreds of other jurisdictions around the country that simply didn't have the resources to fight in the courts to make the argument that they know that their policies do the right thing and that they uphold the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution. So I think, just again, like, I'm trying where possible to extract the reminder that, you know, there's the imposition of all these horrible changes on us and the communities that we live in and love. And then there's also been a powerful response that's happened outside of Washington, D.C. And so that sort of game of chicken has been playing out in the litigation in California, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, where localities have said, you know, you cannot have these vague looming threats, and we're not changing our policies in response to that. There's obviously been some exceptions to that, notably Miami, for example. But I think that, again, for the most part, localities have really held together in pushing back. And I think that at the same time, as I mentioned before, people have really sort of adopted the concept of sanctuary to extend far beyond the law enforcement context. So again, you know, in civil society spaces, really people saying, you know, we may not be able to change the federal law, but there is something, particularly when trying to challenge an administration, that is beyond shame in many situations. I think people really understanding the importance of documenting, publicizing rights, teaching people what those rights are. We've seen that. We've seen the people on an individual level in homes, places of employment, like the exercise of those rights, which can be very intimidating when you're up against ICE officers who may not want to remind you what your rights are. But that has created the ability to delay or stall or essentially build in more time for people to fight against ICE enforcement activities. And that's been really important. So the concept and the notion of sanctuary, fraught as it is with differing meanings, if you're a law enforcement officer, if you're a faith community leader, I do think that the concept in spirit has been much more widely embraced, where people recognize that it's essentially like a community defense model, however it plays out and by whichever agency or you know, community leaders is espousing that in practice and in policy. So I think that, you know, we'll see what happens with the litigation. The administration is really, you know, persistent and engaging in continued in intimidation tactics. Just before I was coming over here, I saw there was a press release about 23 jurisdictions now being subpoenaed for information about how they're refusing to provide information to ICE. I'm not sure what documents they're specifically looking for. They have all of their policies. So, you know, I think that, again, just shows that there's a real relentlessness to trying to, even as these victories are playing out for the localities and the courts, to keep persisting. So I think that, you know, we'll see, but for the time being, you know, there's a nationwide injunction in place that prevents the application of the language and the Interior Enforcement Executive Order from applying to localities. We always knew that the law was on our side. The Supreme Court has held in many other instances that, you know, you can't coerce localities into doing the job of a federal agencies. But I think that, you know, we never expected, I can't say I expected, you know, that this administration would be so persistent in its willingness to just ignore the law. And we'll talk about it, I think, in some of the later parts of the conversation. It really becomes really important for us to really maintain very close relationships and have our ears to the ground, because what is technically legal, and you know, we can't rely on DHS to be really spelling out for a lot of localities, and it can obviously be very intimidating when you have the federal government selling a program or an idea or something to you, a memo that they've come up with that directly contradicts what we have, you know, helped counter these arguments by DHS. And so I think that the don't underestimate, I guess, misinformation and the willingness to peddle misinformation under this administration. That shouldn't have to be said, but unfortunately, I think that's been something that we've actually, I personally can say, underestimated how much of the fight would be just around that battle.
Well said. I do have many more questions, but I want to open it up to folks in the room and to folks on the phone. We did start 5 minutes late, and we have a little flexibility to go even another 5 minutes longer. So we do have time for some questions. For folks on the phone, I said at the outset, but just to repeat, we have an email. If we're not going to unmute the lines, so we can keep this somewhat orderly. But you can email your questions to policy@imcouncil.org. I-M as in Mary, M as in Mary, Council, C-O-U-N-C-I-L.org. But in the meantime, we'll take questions in the room. Karen.
Hi, thank you. I had one for Chris on the 92% with final orders. Does that include only final administrative order, so that anybody who has an open MTR or a circuit appeal is for that purpose considered to be final?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that speaks to how ICE is putting out numbers without the underlying data. But as I understood the secretary's answer, I would think they use the definition of BIA adjudication being a final order. And so I do think that the 8% is something that really needs further investigation, but the 92% should be broken down into these categories, but also types of final orders, of course, you know, who actually got through the BIA, who has in absentia, who is 30-year orders, et cetera. And I think some of the FOIA work, we have touched only briefly on some of the efforts through litigation and other methods of advocacy to keep the administration accountable. But I think the FOIA work is absolutely crucial to uncovering what they are trying to sell as a targeted type of enforcement.
I think some of the recent, the targeting of the community activists and so forth, those were where ICE was saying they had final orders and all approvals were exhausted, but in some cases they did have other legal actions. So I don't know how large the number is, but it seems like it's what you're saying, it's an important distinction.
Okay, we'll take another. And if you can say your name and your affiliation when you speak. I should have asked Karen to do the same.
Sure. I'm Simon from Legal Aid Justice Center in Falls Church, Virginia. A question for Avida and Chris, I guess. My sense is that the system is pretty much firing on all cylinders right now. You know, we've seen like a 40% increase in total interior arrests year over year. At first, they were having trouble getting the number of interior deportations up, but they're getting those up as well. Absent some huge new appropriation from Congress, do you see any room for, you know, like dramatic increases of the same kind in 2018? I'm just not seeing how they can do that. I think they're running out of low-hanging fruit.
Well, I'll take a stab at this, and Chris, please share your thoughts. You know, just to give one example that Royce had alluded to, that we anticipate that we'll start to see more of is worksite enforcement. I think early in 2017, for NILC at least, our assumption was, okay, we have to gear up and be prepared for what much of what we saw back in 2006. And then it wasn't happening. Plenty of other things were happening, as you mentioned, as we've talked about. But that specific style of enforcement and targeting of workers at work sites wasn't happening in the way that we predicted. And now we have seen a much more public pronouncement and commitment to that. So we'll see how that materializes. You know, I heard of what I, for me, was one of the first examples of harboring prosecutions of I believe it was in Arizona, and you know, we are expecting an increased number of, Chris mentioned this before, prosecutions of unlawful reentries for people on in the interior. You know, a lot of, Royce mentioned this sort of in the framing, like a lot of last year was just kind of getting, as much as we, there's a lot of disorganization in the administration, there's a lot that actually just they needed to fill certain roles. We pay a lot of attention to what's not happening, like the State Department has all these vacancies, and at the same time, there is a rapid approval of getting more judges in place that are actually going to help execute a lot of what is in the executive order. So I think there is actually quite a lot of room to see more, and I wouldn't underestimate what, you know, I think many of us have recognized that the appropriations fight is essentially trying to destroy like the central nervous system of the entire agency and its ability to have this multiplier effect of engaging in more and more enforcement tactics and styles. But even without that, I mean, there's so much that we've described that really doesn't change necessarily. It doesn't require additional personnel. It will create more backlogs, as Chris was saying, and it will put more pressures on certain parts of the system, but it doesn't require changes in the law. And that, I think, is actually one of the hardest things for us to both track the impact of those informal changes in practice and to really take stock of like how often that's happening.
Can I add something real quick? I would only add in terms of low-hanging fruit, we've talked a lot this past year about them expanding the pool of people that could be targeted. So with 300,000 people likely losing their TPS when all is said and done, with DACA status or, you know, with the program, you know, expiring, you know, with more and more people losing those protections and that information residing with DHS, although it's unclear how that information would actually be used by enforcement, I think the risk is profound that you could have close to 1 million people potentially who are suddenly in the crosshairs of ICE.
And just a couple of quick points. I'm more pessimistic in part because of what we mentioned before about cutting process, you know, in terms of not taking as long to deport the individuals who are going into the system at a higher rate. But the other thing, and this is a plug for the next panel, is a lot depends on the detention system. The site fights are incredibly important on their own terms, but also systemically, because that's a rate-limiting step often for deportation. The second point is just, I'm not sure they were firing on all cylinders this year for a couple of reasons. First of all, Operation Mega, you'll remember, which was called off, we understand, because of the natural disasters in September, but that was going to target 15,000 people. The numbers for Northern California that came out in the last couple of weeks, you know, again, 1,500 people. These are major, large-scale operations that they appear to have detention capacity to deal with. And then the wild card is really the question of how the politics figures in terms of this ongoing negotiation process about DACA. Is there some direction from the White House not to go full bore on enforcement while this process is playing out? And I really am devastated, of course, with the roller coaster that Dreamers have experienced. I think if there is a deal, but of course, if there isn't, there will be a renewed push on enforcement, either for those who are excluded from the deal or a big push on enforcement, as Royce was saying, across the board. And so I do think the numbers are something that we know right at the top is a big issue. Comparison to Obama will be very intense for year two. And combined with these other factors we've discussed, I think there may be capacity, and certainly there's a lot of drive to do more.
Do we have another question in the room? I don't think we have any from the phone. Josh, we're going to hand you a, if you can introduce yourself. Even though I know you, Jennifer.
Yeah. Jennifer Quigley from Human Rights First. So I'm not necessarily sure if you want to answer this panel, but AG Sessions says that he's going to review admin closures. We're also, of course, expecting some pending memos on UAC's jurisdiction, other changes for asylum. And so I just wonder, you know, especially since I don't think what Sessions decides on admin closure will come in our favor, you know, what do people sort of see as like the next phase?
Though I have not personally seen this, I've heard from other attorneys and various jurisdictions that some immigration judges are already declining to administratively close cases because they're not certain that they have that authority. So even without anything happening yet with that particular case, it's already had an impact.
And I can, to your point, Jennifer, about unaccompanied kids and their sponsors, I do think that that's going to be a high priority for ICE as soon as the coming months. You know, I think we are, I know it's happened on a smaller scale already, but I don't think it's been a policy shift. And I do think that they, and the secretary alluded to this when she was testifying last week before the Senate Judiciary Committee, that they are looking at ways to deter people from bringing their kids. And this is our understanding of at least one of those ways, that they will be working with ORR to vet sponsors who come to pick up kids and, you know, vetting them for their immigration status and taking into custody those who don't have status to have a chilling effect on either children coming, children identifying their parents. And I think that's going to, you know, have some very problematic consequences either with children coming and languishing longer in ORR's care, ending up in the care of others who they identify, you know, or legal guardians being assigned, you know, by family members to pick up their kids. I think we're going to have some big problems. And then there will, of course, be kids who don't end up coming and staying in harm's way as a result of that deterrence. I did want to ask, because it was referenced, unless you had other answers to Jennifer's question, I did want to, you know, since I think, Heather, you have the most ongoing working relationship with ICE through your work with the liaison committee for AILA. Obviously, you have it at a local level as well. You know, the national conversation for NGOs has largely been suspended. You know, we're not really in the way we had been talking with ICE. There doesn't seem to be enough will or common ground to have a productive conversation, and that's putting it mildly. It seems like you may be having, or you and others may be having, more success at a local level, and maybe we can close this discussion on a happier note, but with your suggestions for ways to engage, you know, more effectively.
Well, I'll just give a brief overview for those who aren't familiar. The way the liaison system works with AILA is that we have local ICE liaisons in the various AILA jurisdictions. They meet with the local offices, both offices of chief counsel as well as ERO, and are typically they don't tend to get favorable responses from HSI about scheduling appointments, but ERO and OCC do tend to respond to these local meetings. ICE meets with our national committee twice a year. That hasn't stopped up to this point. We have a meeting scheduled with them for April. And what we do as a committee is we get feedback mm-hmm. from the local liaisons, what's going on the ground in your jurisdictions. We ask that our members try to resolve their issues locally first and then bring them to our attention after they've tried to deal with it at the local level. And then there are 11 members of our current committee. We all come from different areas in the country, and we bring our experiences together when we draft our agenda for each meeting, taking into consideration different trends that we're seeing nationally. What we used to do under prior administrations was we'd say, hey, ICE, here's where it's working, here's where it's not. How can we make things work better, right? You know, and we try to work with them because this really is a collaborative process. We feel that when AILA attorneys or any attorneys understand what the policies are, they're better able to advise their clients, and it makes it easier for ICE to carry out its policies because there's an understanding on both sides. So to that extent, we hope that they continue this mutual relationship. Following the change in administration, we no longer highlight where it's good or bad. Instead, we bring questions more generally. They tend to be more focused on policy. And we're looking for answers to these questions so that people have an idea of how things work. But although they're still meeting with us, they have cut back significantly on the information that they share. For example, in August, I don't know if it was a memo, I really don't know what it was, but some sort of memo, some sort of guidance was released to the field. And it had to do with prosecutorial discretion. We're told that it also included many other things in there. And because of attorney-client privilege, law enforcement sensitive, and all sorts of other reasons, they can't let us see what it is. So there's this special guidance to the field that we're no longer familiar with. And this is a very significant change with how things have operated in the past. There's a lack of transparency. What I would encourage, and I think has been most successful over the past year, are cultivating those local relationships. Maybe not even through your ICE liaison locally, but if you have an officer that you have some sort of rapport with in ERO, if there's a trial attorney that you think seems to be pretty reasonable, talk to them, pick up the phone, try to do things a little less formally. For those of you who are practitioners, you likely know that there are no more email addresses to submit prosecutorial discretion requests. Those don't exist anymore. Although prosecutorial discretion is significantly curtailed, I don't think that you should ever give up pushing for what you think is right and advocating for your client. I think that you're going to be better served by doing that directly with the trial attorney or the ERO officer that's going to be handling the case, as opposed to some sort of formalistic request that is elevated to chief counsel. And, you know, those sorts of processes don't exist anymore. But having those one-on-one relationships where you can look someone in the eye and ask them to be reasonable, and also be reasonable in your expectations, I think that that's just kind of where we need to be right now.
Thank you, Heather. That's very helpful. All right, with that, we'll conclude. We're going to take a 10-minute break so that folks can use the restroom, which is out here and to the left, get some refreshments. And if you didn't have a chance to, please pick up some of the documents and handouts that are out there on the counter. Folks on the phone, bear with us for about 10 minutes, and we will resume. Do what you need to over those next 10 minutes.
Hey everyone, I think everyone is sitting back down mostly. All right, so we will get started with the second panel. Thanks everyone for sticking around for the second half. As Royce mentioned, the first half sort of covered enforcement. And the second half, we're gonna sort of cover detention over the past year under the Trump administration. Let me quickly introduce the panel and we can get going because I know we have a hard stop at 4. So immediately to my left is Mary Small, who is the policy director at Detention Watch Network. Next to her is Heidi Altman, who is the director of policy at National Immigrant Justice Center. And then at the end is my colleague, Katie Shepherd, who is the National Advocacy Council for the Immigrant Justice Campaign at the Council and AILA. It's quite the title. And then I am Josh Weisblatt with the Council. One thing I did want to note at the top, and it was something that the panel talked about beforehand when we met to sort of discuss what we were going to talk about. And we realized we are four white people up here talking to you about immigrants in detention. I would not trade any of my panelists for anybody, but it was sort of the way the panel sort of shook out. And we at the council have always noted we need to be more intentional about that. So it was something I wanted to make sure I noted, and it was just something I thought that was important to say. I wasn't sure if either of you and any of you wanted to comment or add anything with that before we started. Okay, cool. All right. So with the panel itself, detention under the Trump administration. So first, as Royce mentioned, tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of the first executive orders that Trump put out on immigration. In the order, or at least in one of them, there was a call for additional detention. And as Heidi has pointed out to me, it was more at the border than anything else, but there was a call for additional detention facilities. And then in early February, the Trump administration talked about its new budget that it was going to be proposing for 2018. And in that budget, they requested an addition for basically over 51,000 detention beds, when before no more than 34,000 had ever been funded. So we're talking about a huge, almost 50% increase in the number of beds. And so I was going to start with Mary and more or less ask, how did they do? What did the Trump administration actually accomplish in its first year in its desire to expand detention?
Thanks, Josh. I think a couple of things to flag before jumping into the answer to that question is that, one, at the end of the Obama administration, so right before the executive branch was handed over to Trump, we actually had a massive spike in the size of the detention system, up to the highest number of people detained per day that we had ever seen, up to 42,000 people per day from what had been basically a decade average in the low to mid 30,000 people per day. And so I think that there's, and I understand that the framing of this entire event is 1 year under Trump, but I think we have to be really careful to acknowledge that there's pieces of this that are about policy changes driven by the Trump administration. And there are pieces of this that were set up and teed up by the Obama administration, and pieces of this that are fundamentally actually about the culture inside of ICE and CBP. And so making sure that we're not conflating all of that into a Trump problem to the degree that we're talking about that. So flagging that. Kind of backing up before I get into how did they do and how are they about to do, as it were. So Detention Watch Network had a convening in early January of a ton of our members from all over the country. And basically the anticipation that we laid out there for the year for detention were four big themes: that it was going to become bigger, that it was going to become less transparent, that we were going to see worsening conditions, and that we were going to see an increase in criminalization and a further marrying of the DHS and DOJ systems when it came to actual criminal charges against immigrants. So to the degree that those are four big themes: bigger, less transparent, worsening conditions, and increasing criminalization, all four of those things have happened, and we'll get into that. And then on all four of those things, there are some very clear things that are continuing to kind of come down the pike that we're going to see in 2018. So as Josh said, the president requested funding for over 51,000 detention beds, but there was also a whole bunch of policy stuff that got rolled out in the president's budget request as well. And one thing to flag that I think Heidi's going to follow up on is a specific plan that was laid out to lower detention standards in the overwhelming majority of facilities. And I think to the degree that we're trying to understand what's happening in detention, it's important to break down the way that they presented it. So the way that the document lays it out basically says there's this very small number of facilities that are shiny balls that we hope you'll pay attention to, where we are supposedly going to improve conditions. And because it's so shiny over here, where we're supposedly maybe going to improve conditions, we hope you won't notice that we plan to drop the bottom out of standards for all of the rest of the facilities and have even less kind of accountability or oversight into what's happening. So that was previewed in the president's budget request. While we've seen some kind of steps towards that hasn't been fully implemented yet, as we understand it, in large part because ICE is holding off until they get their funding for next year, because they don't want to antagonize appropriators before the funding is fully baked.
So as you all know, the whole funding question continues to be all of our collective purgatory. And so final, does anyone disagree with that assessment? It's right, like it's just never ending. What'd you say? Okay, Heidi's voting for hell, which is a strange quotation, take it out of context. Hi folks on the phone. At any rate, the final numbers for how much funding ICE will have for all parts of their operations, but especially for detention for next year, are pending. But I think it's really important that we not lose track of two things that make that number very squishy, whatever it is, which is the first of which is ICE has a very clear history of overspending their appropriation, expecting Congress to bail them out on the back end, and then Congress doing that. And so that makes the number squishy. ICE also has, even and especially escalated over the last couple of years, shown that they will also dramatically overcrowd their facilities. And so that combination, the fact that they'll spend more money than they're given, and that they will deliberately overcrowd their facilities, in some ways kind of legally and technically, and in some ways completely outside the bounds of what they're supposed to do, mean that while it's really important for us who want to limit the number of people held in detention to fight on funding, that by itself isn't going to completely constrain the size of the system, or to Simon's question from earlier, whether or not there's kind of more room to ramp up with existing resources. And I guess the last thing that I will say in my opening remarks about this expansion, specifically related to the overall size of the system, is I think it's really important for us to, when we're looking at the detention system overall, to understand that the detention system is expanding at the same time in two completely different directions. And I feel like in my conversations with reporters, they're inevitably focused on one or the other, and we have to understand that it's both. So one form of expansion is the increase in large, dedicated, usually privatized detention facilities that are intended to significantly add capacity, to add a lot more beds to the system. And so the clearest example of this is the request for information that was put out for a few months ago, looking for detention, the big, dedicated, likely privatized detention facilities within a 180-mile radius of Detroit, Chicago, St. Paul, and Salt Lake City. So that's one way that this is expanding, and that layers onto a lot of narratives about candidate Trump talking about supporting private prisons, about the revolving door between high levels of leadership at ICE and the private prison companies. Sort of that layers onto that piece of the narrative and the work. But there's this other form of expansion that we're seeing that is really also important not to lose track of, which is an increasing number of small local detention contracts with local governments. So these end up being called IGSAs, intergovernmental service agreements. Most of them are small and aren't actually going, not to minimize the experience of the people who were held in those facilities, but numerically don't end up holding that many immigrants, but are about deepening ICE's collaboration with local law enforcement. And I think that this is the other part of the answer to the question about whether or not ICE is at full capacity. To the degree that ICE is deepening its relationships with local law enforcement, who they view in many cases as force multipliers, there's a lot of room to grow and a lot of room to use local law enforcement as a proxy to help pull more people into that dragnet. And so there's several different ways in which these like small local detention contracts are also expanding. But I think we just have to understand that ICE, like all of us, has multiple goals that they're pursuing at the same time. And so the big dedicated privatized facilities are largely about massively increasing the capacity of the system. The tiny little IGSAs that are popping up all over the place, 54 that were newly signed or reactivated since last year, by our count, as best we can tell, or the fact that localities are increasingly marrying together detention contracts with 287G agreements because of the synergies between those two programs. That's not about detention capacity, although it does have that, that does do that. That's about deepening ICE's collaboration with local law enforcement and other benefits that provides from ICE's perspective. So making sure that we're not losing track of like the way in which the system is growing in these two different ways, I would say is like one of the overarching things that I think gets missed when we're talking about detention expansion under the Trump administration.
That was a very good overview. Thank you, Mary. So I think that that hits on and actually dovetails very well into what I was going to ask Heidi about. So we're seeing detention expanding in multiple ways, and it's happening in a variety of ways. And so what, if anything, has been happening to actually keep any of that in check? Is there anything that either has been happening on the ground or through government agencies that has actually done anything to sort of put a cog in the wheels, so to speak?
Okay, thanks, Josh. Yeah, I mean, I think I'll start answering that question by noting that almost everything that Mary just shared, we're only able to share because of really hard-fought litigation by Detention Watch Network and others, which is all to say that, you know, we're starting from a place of an absolute lack of transparency from ICE on any of this. And so even finding out the answer to the question of what growth has there been, as Mary and I were sitting next to each other in the back and we both kind of leaned over to each other, like, what's your best most recent, you know, average detention population data? And mine was from a journalist who had gotten it apparently from the government, but as of September, and I think yours was the same, right? Like these very, very basic facts about what the system looks like, how many people are in the system, where those people are lacking and are only coming to us through fights in the courts and elsewhere. So to your question, Josh, right, what do we do then with this system where there's no transparency? I am a person who, when I have like two things on my plate, I like to eat the thing that I like most last. So I'm going to start with the bad news, and then I'm gonna end with a slightly more uplifting note. So what that means is that I'm going to start with like a quick overview of what our government's own accountability mechanisms are supposed to be. And that's like the peas on the Brussels sprouts because it's not working. Then I'm going to move on to talk about, what is happening on the ground where there have been victories to celebrate. And I think there's some hopefulness moving forward. But so government oversight mechanisms rely a lot on the conversation that Mary started about what the detention standards are that are supposed to govern. And I think most of you in the room are slightly familiar with those standards. They are not binding, right? So like if you are a person and you're in an immigration jail and you are very well aware of the fact that one of the governing standards has been violated and that has harmed you, that does not give you any legal action, any right to a legal action. Nonetheless, they exist and they range from a set of standards that were developed in 2000 called the National Detention Standards to the most recent set of standards, which you'll hear called PBNDS, Performance-Based National Detention Standards from 2011, although those have actually been subsequently amended. You still hear them called PBNDS 2011. The reason why these are so important is because, check me if I'm wrong, everybody else on this panel, but every government accountability mechanism of the detention system is going to act in deference to the set of standards that is governing at the facility they're looking at, right? So ICE conducts its own inspections of its own facilities, looking for compliance or lack of compliance with the set of standards that is governing in that facility according to the contract that ICE has entered into with the jailer. Similarly, when the Office of the Inspector General within DHS does their own inspections or reporting, they're going to judge a facility on the basis of its compliance or lack thereof with the standards governing that facility. So this is really important because that's a really low bar, right? First of all, the standards, even the most recent set, are all developed very clearly on a correctional model, which, you know, was not appropriate in a civil detention setting. The older standards are so out of date that just an example I like to use, if you look at the 2000 standards, is that you can show compliance with access to a law library and legal resources under the 2000 standards by having access to a typewriter. So there's no requirements that there be any kind of computer or computer-based services available in those libraries. But that's just one example of how, so like, it's not just that they're bad in terms of basic kind of health and living conditions, is that they're completely out of date. My count is that when ICE says looking forward that they're going to have the most recent 2011 standards in all of the dedicated facilities, that is 24 of the 201 facilities. Does that sound about right to you? That we know are currently operational. So that means that that's 177 facilities that ICE currently does not have, or wouldn't fall within the category of jails that ICE says going forward they're going to consider must be bound by the most recent standards, and instead will be bound by this very vague new set of minimal standards that we still haven't even seen coming out of this administration. So, you know, just to kind of put a cap on the government accountability mechanisms, ICE's own inspection system, as you can imagine, is very, very, very lacking. the inspections look at whether a policy is in place that says it is compliance with a standard, rather than looking at whether that compliance is actually happening. The jails are given advance notice of the inspections, and basically we see continued, and you know, has been documented by many of the organizations in this room, continued whitewashing of those inspections. Some of you may have seen a couple months ago that the Office of the Inspector General released, this is DHS's own Office of the Inspector General, released its first report with the results of some unannounced spot inspections, right? So a very different model from what ICE does. And those were, you know, pretty shocking. Found, not surprisingly to any of you who've been in one of these jails, that the conditions were so lacking as to be basically unacceptable and unable to provide for the basic health and safety of those who are inside jailed. So, you know, we're hopeful that there will be more, and certainly there's a big push for the OIG to do more unannounced spot inspections like that. We also understand at the same time that they don't have the funds to currently do so, because everything else within DHS is quite well funded when it comes to enforcement, but we are very worried about funding in the next appropriation cycle for OIG. So, you know, happy to answer questions about government accountability mechanisms, but what I did want it to sort of segue into is just to take a moment to acknowledge that, you know, not just under this administration, but for many, many years now, there has been a really incredible series of victories of local community coalitions quickly gathering in resistance when there is an announcement or somehow a discovery that ICE is looking to enter into a contract either with a local county jail or in partnership with a private prison company. And just 2 days ago was a recent example of this, where there was a discovery in November that Core Civic, which used to be CCA, was going to try to put up it's still unclear, somewhere between an 1,100 and 1,400 bed facility in Elkhart County, Indiana. What happened between November until 2 days ago was like astonishing to behold. The community just rose up, and there's a lot that I think we can learn from this, but the one thing that I do want to highlight, and then we can talk about it if folks have questions, is that Indiana is a red state. Elkhart County is a red county. And in talking with some of the decision makers there and talking with the organizers and the activists who were a big part of this, one of the things they kept saying over and over again is, this is no longer a partisan issue. Right? Like, what is happening in the immigration detention system is so appalling that whether you are a person who considers yourself an abolitionist and you think that the entire system needs to be shut down, or you are a person who believes strongly in ramping up enforcement and detention, but you think that when people are jailed, they should be done so in a way that respects their basic due process in human and civil rights, wherever you fall along that spectrum, today, understanding what is happening in the jails and what's happening, you cannot, as a person of good conscience, want an immigration jail in your community. and that, you know, what happened in Elkhart is that it started with the county's kind of traditional immigrant activists, immigrants' rights activists, faith-based leaders, and then slowly it grew until the mayor of the town, Goshen, and a really huge variety of business leaders stepped up, and you know, until it was clear that there was a near consensus actually against the opening of this jail, and then it was over. CoreCivic withdrew their proposal. So I think there's a lot to learn there, and I hope that this will be repeated. CoreCivic actually hired a PR firm to try to make this happen, and that PR firm reached out to faith-based leaders in the community to try to make the case that this jail would be an opportunity for them. They referred to it as a mission field in their backyards. And I think that this was a great opportunity for a lot of education that happened very quickly in the community, so that those same leaders were like, you know, hey, CoreCivic, we're not going to be played. and we're able to come back with, you know, with facts and with really strong evidence about what was happening in other CoreCivic facilities to say that we know that this is just not the way this system operates. There's no way that external players can make this a place that, you know, in any way accords with justice. So that's something to celebrate. And Detention Watch Network, I have to say, has been a really incredible leader in making sure that the lessons learned from these site fights go forward across the country.
Great. Thanks, Haid. And thank you for having a little positive. These are, to me, these panels and these days are always, I feel like sometimes we always just have like negative information. Royce and I have done like a few of these, and it's just like hammering the like negative, like bad things that have happened. So it's always nice to be able to like lift up the positive things.
Anytime.
Yeah. Speaking of all of the, just so much positive things, I was going to move over to Katie. And Katie, I was going to ask you to talk a little bit about sort of what has been happening in family detention. There obviously has not been a desire or an attempt yet to expand family detention, but sort of what has been happening and what has changed under the Trump administration, and then sort of what policies or things that were actually somewhat alluded to a little bit on the first panel is the administration looking at, like as it relates to like family separation and things like that, to actually try and deter families to come so that they don't need family detention.
Sure. Thank you so much. So I actually first wanted to start out by giving kudos to all the immigration lawyers and advocates on the front lines who are doing this work, because practicing immigration in any capacity a couple years ago was already really, really difficult. And now we have what's happening now, and it's really, really almost impossible, I think. And kudos also to all the brave people behind bars who are fighting their cases, which I can't imagine doing. So taking Heidi's cue, I think this is going to be like my Brussels sprouts or peas or something like that. But talking of family detention, not much has changed. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a bad thing. It's hard to say. There's still currently over 3,000 beds committed to the incarceration of mothers, fathers, and their minor children, the vast majority of whom are seeking humanitarian relief in the United States. Many of them, all of them are being held in facilities that are both unlicensed and secure. In violation of the Flores Settlement Agreement, which is the agreement that governs the conditions and detention of immigrant children in this country. There have been recent pushes to try to challenge the continued detention of children in these conditions. But as of yet, we have to see the government held accountable for violating the Flores Agreement on a daily basis. I also wanted to add that in Dili alone, as of December 2017, the project down there saw 12,000 families just over the course of 2017. And that, of course, doesn't take into account all the thousands of families that were seen by RISIS in Karnes and Aldea in Berks County, which, of course, holds only about 85 to 90 people. So needless to say, this is a huge number of asylum-seeking individuals, vulnerable individuals who are being cycled through expedited removal and being incarcerated, even though there are multiple reasonable, more humane, less costly alternatives available. And I realize I'm preaching to the choir here. Moving on to a possibly more insidious and less humane policy of family separation. Last March, 2017, the Trump administration made threats of introducing a border-wide systemic policy of separating families at the U.S.-Mexico border as a form of deterring future migration to the United States. Later that same month in March, they walked back the threats and basically said they were not going to do it. In leading up to December of last year, they again suggested that they were going to implement this policy. Several organizations, including the American Immigration Council, Women's Refugee Commission, and others, filed an administrative complaint in December, which basically lifted up a handful of cases in which families had been separated and demonstrating the significant due process violations and legal implications of this policy. About a week ago, during a Senate Judiciary Oversight Committee hearing, I think that's right, it's a mouthful, Senator Feinstein questioned Secretary Nielsen on the record and again made remarks that really drove home the point that this is not a humane policy and should not be resorted to in any circumstance. As it stands, the most recent intel is that family separation will not be implemented as a policy on the border, but only time will tell what happens in the coming months. I also wanted to speak a little bit about changes in release and parole practices in this country. Over the past several months, we've seen a marked decrease in the number of requests for parole being granted by ICE, and bond amounts being very, very high, which detainees are simply unable to pay, which essentially means that they're forced to fight their cases behind bars.
Is that better?
Oh, whoa, sorry. Okay, I just wanted to, that's a lot louder. Sorry, people on the phone. I did want to cite one specific example of, and there's so many, and this could, we could be talking for several hours about changes in release and parole practices in detention right now. But a few cases out of Colorado. Last summer, we saw an influx, and I hate that word influx because it describes human beings and it just feels weird. But we saw an influx of Haitians coming to the United States asking for relief in different ways. And ICE systematically increased the requirements for Haitians requesting parole or release from detention so that the Haitian detainees were required to produce original identity documents in order to be released. This is totally ludicrous. It actually led to most Haitians in Aurora being detained for 10 to 12 months, which is far longer than any other population. And it is, of course, impossible for someone with a fear-based claim to go to their consulate, which is a representative of their government from which they are fleeing, to request these documents. So to me, this is just one example of the incredibly cruel, inhumane, senseless practices that this administration is resorting to these days. And then I wanted to draw your attention to a recent class action lawsuit that AIC and, let me get this right, Capital Area Immigrants Rights Coalition, I think I see Claudia here, and Kali Forsyth Law Group, basically challenging the practice of immigration judges in North Carolina, who had for many months, possibly years, refused to conduct bond hearings for detained immigrants before the Charlotte Immigration Court. It basically asked the district court to stop IJs from refusing to perform their legal and constitutional duty to hold bond hearings. So this is another example of changes in practices, and not just by ICE or CBP at the border, but also in EOIR, in the immigration court system, that has a very damaging long-term effect for those who are detained. And then I wanted to end with something that's slightly more positive and speak for a minute about these new initiatives for to enhance access to counsel that we're seeing since last November in 2016. I wanted to start with, in 2015, the creation of the first city-funded program known as the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project, or NYFUP, which provides universal court-appointed deportation defense counsel and detained cases. Vera actually released a report which basically showed that 48% of cases will end successfully for knife up clients, which constitutes an 1,100% increase for unrepresented cases before knife up. 1,100%. So success with this program will lead to them expanding the program to 12 other cities and counties covering 5 different states. So it's very exciting. And then there are several other non-government funded initiatives, one of which is the Immigration Justice Campaign, which is, as Josh mentioned, a new initiative between AILA and the council to enhance access to counsel for those who are in detention centers and also advocate on their behalf. And then there's SIFI, the Southeast Immigrant Freedom Initiative, which again provides pro bono counsel to those who are detained in the Deep South. And that's it. I'm probably way over time, but.
No, you're fine. No, and you know, I just want to say, one of the things I have found so interesting is it took the country electing Trump president for mayors, governors from all over the country who are now like tripping over themselves to who can fund legal representation for immigrants and who can one up the other one, which is great, but that's what it took for us to sort of get to that point. Which
can I add one more small thing?
Of course.
In my experience, and I learned this from Laura Lichter, who's probably not on the phone right now. She's probably pulling someone off a plane. But the two most important factors in ensuring that someone can actually access a meaningful day in court is, are they detained and do they have an attorney? Which is why this massive expansion, which Heidi and Mary both described very eloquently, is so, so terrible, right?
Yeah. No, that's good. And actually, that segues into two quick follow-ups that I was going to ask the panel. First was, so we talked about how ICE has not lowered detention standards yet, and we think that that is largely because they're waiting for their next appropriation, and they don't want to upset appropriators. And this sort of connects with the first panel's question was, do we think that if, let's say, funding were to stay flat and there weren't to be a massive increase, but they're able to move forward with these changes, can ICE do more with less? So with less standards, and can they do more? And can you sort of like describe, like in theory, what that would look like?
Emphatically, yes. I think the easiest way to understand that numerically is that, so most folks will be familiar with the fact that the overwhelming majority of the detention system is run by contractors. ICE actually owns very few of its own detention facilities. Most are run by private prison companies or the U.S. Marshals or local governments that they contract with. And so for each of these entities that they contract with, there's a per diem payment, like a per person per day payment to hold someone in that facility. And the per diems range from $30 a day at their lowest all the way up to $140. And so it will not surprise anyone that the super cheap per diems correspond with the lowest level of standards, and the more expensive per diems correspond with private prison lobbying and higher standards. You can separate that out how you'd like. But what I can tell you is that if you drop the bottom out of standards, you can slide those per diems way, way, way lower and make the entire thing cheaper. So that's absolutely one possibility. And then a second thing that I can't help but add on, I think whenever we're talking about this standards question, we have to be so careful to make sure that we're asking a two-part question. So one is, what are the official standards? And then the second one, which is what Heidi was alluding to, is, are they meaningfully enforced in any way? Because the answer to the first question, has the Trump administration officially changed the standards yet? The answer to that is no. But I think the answer to the second question is, have they sent really strong signals to their contractors that there is even less oversight and accountability than there was before? The answer to that one is yes. And so there's a degree to which the answer to the first doesn't really matter if the answer to the second is no one's going to call you out if you don't follow a single one of these. And so I think that there's always more room to go down. But I think when we're talking about conditions and standards, we have to make sure that we're keeping in mind both of those. Like, what are the official standards? But if they're not backed up by meaningful accountability and real financial consequences for the contractors, to a certain degree, they don't matter nearly as much as we wish they did.
And then the second question, oh,
you want to add anything?
No. Okay. And then the second question, which we had mentioned that we would touch on if we had a chance, are these new, actually now I'm saying BOAs, but what does it stand for? There it is, basic ordering agreement. So for those who don't know, there was an announcement just last week in Florida of the 17 counties who are basically going to have these basic ordering agreements, basically having basic ordering agreements. Yes, I said that. Where ICE thinks it has found a way around the issue of detainers, where ICE is going to pay $50, a flat fee, for the facility to hold that person that they would like for 48 hours. And they think that by paying for the bed, it is sort of the equivalent of an intergovernmental service agreement for like individual beds on an ad hoc basis for 48 hours at a time. So they think that they have now gotten around localities being sued because that bed is not the localities, it's actually ICE's because they're paying for it. And therefore, they think they've gotten around some of the Fourth Amendment issues related to detainers. So I guess maybe reaction to that and then what it could mean if that were to sort of move forward and what that could mean for detention.
Yes, thank you, because we did intend to mention those and we forgot. So I'm going to invite Ruthie Epstein from the ACLU, who's here, to chime in on anything that we missed. But I'm also going to say, okay, so I think that this is really this basic ordering agreement plan that ICE has put forward is really important, and it kind of pulls together everything you heard in the last panel about enforcement and everything we've been talking about here, and also Josh's last question about how ICE can do more damage with less appropriated funds. So the first thing I'm going to say is that, you know, this is all new, and I think there's a lot of legal analysis going on, but the first wave of reaction that I think I encountered among colleagues and myself as we all started to analyze this was how it interacts with ICE's like continued and doggedly persistent efforts to convince local law enforcement agents that they can hold someone after they should have otherwise been released just because ICE asks them to without it violating federal, state law, or the Constitution. And to that, I would say that it's almost like embarrassing in how clearly they're just, you know, we were talking about this like lipstick on a pig, like ICE just keeps sort of putting forward new ideas. But all they're doing is the same thing. They're still just asking local jails to, at the moment when someone should be released from their custody, engage in a new arrest and hold that person just because of their immigration status, without complying with Fourth Amendment requirements and without any authority provided by state law for engaging in that new arrest. The fact that there's essentially like an acquisitions order where ICE is giving that jail $50 to feed and house that person has absolutely no relation to those legal questions. But the reason why I think it's really important to this panel and to the conversation about detention is because I keep asking myself this question: why did they not just announce that they were entering into new mini intergovernmental service agreements? And, you know, so this gets a little complex, but like we've been talking about the fact that in the detention context, ICE has all these intergovernmental service agreements with local jails where they hold people for 48 hours or for 11 to 12 months, whatever the case is. And that is the same thing that they're asking local jails to do here. But for some reason, instead of using an IGSA, a contract, they're using this essentially kind of acquisitions order, an order for a basic order agreement. I think that it's probably not too big of a leap to say that they're trying to get around all the things that come with contracting, right? A lot of the things that we're talking about today, like making sure that there are standards that govern in that jail, standards that are appropriate to civil immigration detention, such as it were, if there were such a thing, or that they are not, they're not requiring the jail to do the things necessary to have inspections under those standards. And they are not going through a lot of any of the other processes that are required when you are doing a full contract between governmental agencies. So I think we need to be really vigilant as to whether this just remains a tool that they're using in the detainer compliance context, or whether they start to push for it as a cheaper way, whether this is essentially like a harbinger of other efforts to do detention more cheaply and with less oversight.
Thank you. And then actually the very last super final question, you both had mentioned that you both had the most recent number for average daily population. It was back from September. What was that number? I just out of curiosity, because I actually cannot remember what it was. 38,000 for the folks on the phone, which is still a good 10% plus increase in theory since the last appropriations where it was 34,000.
And I think everyone knows, but that's a snapshot number, right? That's like the number of people on average on a given day in the system.
And actually with that, we are happy to go to questions. So folks on the phone, to send in a question, it's as it was on the first panel, it's emailing policy@imcouncil.org. And then for folks in the room, just raise your hand and we'll get you guys mics.
Hi, this is Losman. I work with Advancement Project. I had like just two kind of survey questions for the panelists. One was, I remember the orders asked for or talked about the expansion of short-term holding facilities. So I thought about CBP Yeleiras, the ICE boxes, and it's almost like they want to expand more of those and also be able to keep people longer. So there was that. So I'm just curious if you have any intel on that. The other thing is when you were talking about just the expansion of detention, I think the other thing is about kind of like the vultures that come with detention. And I think about the evils of the voluntary work program, which is not voluntary. I think about the phone companies that I think it's something like $13 for like 3 minutes. I think about people being fed something that looks like dog food so that they are working for a dollar a day so they can buy more food with the commissary. So I didn't know, you know, if you could comment on that, because all those companies are all making so much money. So I'm just curious about the short-term facilities and about those vultures.
Thank you.
Who wants to take that one?
I'm taking these? Sure.
All right. I'm going working backwards on the vultures, as we're calling them. Yes, absolutely. So in addition to the handful led by the Geo Group and Core Civic, but there's other ones as well, private prison companies that actually run and operate entire detention facilities, for folks who may not know, there's a ton of other companies that provide detention-related services. So the things that you mentioned, but also another, like probably the biggest moneymaker, is actually companies that provide medical care for incarceration, including detention. So yes, all of them are continuing to make money, and I think are looking for ways to capitalize on the anticipated expansion as well. I don't have a ton else to add there other than that's definitely a dynamic that's at play.
I also think that these conditions that you're describing in the Yeleiras and elsewhere, children sleeping on concrete floors, being pulled out of a river still wet and then being put into an icebox and so on and so forth, this is all by design. So it's not just about the financial bottom line. It's about deterrence and deterring future people from coming to the U.S.
And actually, I think just as a point of like, I think it's someone was recently talking about Trump years, like as like dog years, like it feels like there's seven of them inside of one or something. But just to like remind us and not lose track of the fact that like it was just over a year ago that DHS was actually like to some degree investigating the question of whether or not privatized immigration detention should continue, right? It wasn't that long ago that the Department of Justice issued a memo saying we're going to stop doing privatized, we're going to stop holding contracts with private prison companies. Secretary Johnson came under tremendous pressure to say, why would you, working with the exact same companies, come to a different conclusion? Set up an advisory committee to investigate that exact question. And My favorite fun fact about this is that Secretary Kelly was an original participant in that study group before he then became the secretary of DHS. But right, like the fact that this was a contested question in our society was not that long ago. And now we've moved really far where the kind of expectation that all of these private companies will be able to profit off of this growth in the system is kind of a foregone conclusion. So just to name that shift and make sure that we're not like losing track of that one. And then to the question about, I mean, your question's about the expansion of CBP facilities, and I would defer to others in the room, but just to name another thing that I think we're all tracking is the collapsing and closer collaboration between different parts of the system. So the intertwining of CBP and ICE to facilitate faster deportations for folks who are apprehended at or near the border. But the other one is a closer collaboration, and we're seeing some initial signs of this between ICE and the U.S. Marshals, particularly as they're ramping up criminal prosecutions, immigration-related criminal prosecutions. There's a massive efficiency to be had there if they don't have to transfer people between facilities when they're being held by ICE on civil immigration charges and by the U.S. Marshals on immigration-related criminal charges. And so that's the other place where I think we're going to, in the next couple of years, see a much tighter collaboration and likely the physical collapsing of facilities into shared facilities.
I think we have a question in the back or on the phone. Which one did you want to? Oh, okay, well, we have both. We'll first do the one in the room.
Hi. I have a question in terms of if you could speak more about the BOAs. Specifically, what I'm trying to get a sense of is before the BOAs, you had people being held for 36 hours, sometimes more, while ICE was going, waiting for ICE to pick them up. And so there was Fourth Amendment violations. Now you have Fourth Amendment violations still with the BOAs and potentially people in ICE custody without being served a notice to appear, potentially with another favorable, I mean, claim that their proceedings are unjust. And so I'm trying to get a sense of where that comes into play and also where the BOAs are specifically being created. It seems it's mostly in Florida, but if the jails are very specific to like a criminal population where there might be people with FAROs, and so that's not going to be an issue, et cetera. Thank you.
Thanks, Claudia. Should I? So I think just to answer the end first, it's 17 jurisdictions in Florida, and then ICE said that it's like a pilot and they intend to roll this out nationally. And I think, I'm looking to Ruthie, but my sense is that this is not about the population in those 17 jurisdictions, but more about politics, and that the sheriffs in those jurisdictions are sheriffs that very much were looking for any possible way to cooperate more and more deeply with ICE. In terms of like the mechanics, so I have not seen, I'm scanning the room, ICE claiming that the BOA actually in any way converts someone to actually being in ICE custody. The person still remains in the custody of the local law enforcement agency, whether it's the jail or usually a jail. But it does, they are arguing that I don't know that we'll know for sure what their legal argument is going to be until this is inevitably litigated, but it seems from like the questions and answers that were being circulated that what they are arguing is that this sort of cooperative agreement shifts the liability to ICE instead of having it remain on the local law enforcement actor. Even if they are right on that, there is still liability under Bivens and other vehicles as well. But that is what they're arguing. So, I mean, I think for all intents and purposes, for us, it's important to remember that this actually changes nothing. The BOA is just a payment. It's a mechanism for a payment, a reimbursement, basically, from ICE to the jail for those 48 hours. And ICE is still maintaining that after the 48 hours, they understand that they're no longer requesting continued detention. Claudia, did that get at your questions? Okay.
We had a question from the listeners on the phone from Natalie Lyons from the Southern Poverty Law Center, who asked whether there is any value in the current environment in filing administrative complaints. And if so, what that value would be.
Definitely yes. I think, right? I mean, we have very few ways of holding the government accountable right now, and this has proven over the past 12 months to be potentially very effective. With the complaint that we filed a year ago, documenting the government's illegal practice of turning asylum seekers away at the ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border, which led to litigation filed in July. The second complaint that the council filed this year, along with many other amazing organizations, documenting the uptick in ICE's detention of pregnant women. And I think that did lead to a meaningful decrease in pregnant women being detained. And then the third one, which I already referenced, regarding family separation. The answer is yes. Keep doing it.
Just one other thing I would add is, it is obviously very hard to hold them accountable. And even if the complaint itself does not actually immediately create any kind of policy change or do anything, I mean, they're a great advocacy tool to get information out into the media, to bring attention to an issue. So even if you're not, you don't necessarily think that you're going to create some massive big policy change, which is very hard to do anyway, I think it's an important thing to use sort of as it relates for the media. And then also, I think it's helpful to also be able to go to members of Congress and say, we're really concerned about this. Look at this complaint that we filed. There's an investigation open. We need more oversight and accountability on this. And members of Congress many times are willing to ask questions of DHS, ask them in hearings, ask them in letters. And so to me, there is like a big value in doing it, but you have to kind of check that box.
To add one more thing, the two oversight agencies, CRCL and OIG, individually, they have specific mandates so that if you're filing a complaint regarding a particular issue, they have to open up an investigation depending on what the substance of the complaint is. So I think that's important to add. So you should allege as many violations of disability rights as possible in your CRCL complaints, for example.
This is Amy with Global Fund for Children. But so, Katie, when you were talking about the family detention context, you talked a little bit about the language in the Flores settlement about, holding children in secure unlicensed facilities. And I think that licensing piece is a really big victory in the family detention context because GEO and CoreCivic have tried both administratively and legislatively to license family detention centers in the state of Texas. And last year, in the very same legislative session that the Texas legislature passed Senate Bill 4, did not pass a bill to license the family detention centers, right? And in this sort of spirit of how we learn from like the family detention context to the adult detention context, are there thoughts or ideas or efforts to look at state and local level policies, leaders, whatever that may be, to help with sort of what's happening with the standards and inspections in adult facilities?
Yes, but I'm sure there could be more. I think the like prime example of that is has happened in California, that not only phases out the ability of local and state actors to partner with ICE for immigration detention, leaving the Otay Mesa detention facility as the only one that can potentially continue to exist and expand in California, but that also creates an obligation for the California Attorney General's office to do inspections of the existing detention facilities. There's been conversations, this has been an active conversation in Illinois. There's been some more preliminary conversations about introducing legislation in a handful of other states, but I think that there's potentially a lot more room for work there.
Other questions in the room?
Hi. Thank you so much for speaking again. I'm Sonali. I'm from Amnesty International. And I have two questions. The first being that when we talk about individuals from Latin America, we often don't distinguish adequately between immigrants and refugees. I was wondering how ICE is doing on that front. And then I was wondering if you'd speak to specific issues that plague women in detention centers, particularly access to reproductive health care and sexual violence.
Fun topic.
Well, it's generally bad on the second point, right? Women held in detention always have insufficient access to adequate medical and mental health services, and that would also include reproductive health services, of course, which we tried to lift up a little bit in the pregnancy complaint in the fall. And I know also that that would include access to abortion services where a woman may be pregnant, having recently arrived to the United States as a result of rape that happened at the border or en route to the United States fleeing for protection. So do you guys want to expand on that a little bit? I mean, bottom line, the care is insufficient in detention, right? And so this is one of the many reasons that our MO should be to get people out of detention to enhance the likelihood that they can win their cases and achieve the relief that they came to the United States. Right.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think we would just be remiss not to mention that there's, of course, this huge fight in the courts and in the streets about access to abortion for girls who are in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is the agency within the Department of Health and Human Services that has custody over unaccompanied children when they arrive at the border. And it's our understanding that that is a problem that persists and that has now been codified in really clear policy coming from headquarters. Is not being replicated yet in adult custody for ICE in that clear of a way, right? The explicit denial of access to abortion for women is not yet happening in ICE custody for adults. I don't know, before we get to the immigrants versus refugee question, if you want to, that's one.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Well, so, I mean, I think that's such a good question, and I would begin to answer it, and I'm sure everyone in this room has a story of somebody they've worked with, by saying that I think actually we've gone a step further. The administration has gone a step further, although we already saw inklings of this in the previous administration, which is actually an intentional attempt to blur any of those lines, right? So that you now hear the administration talking really clearly about attempting to deter what they call illegal migration, which is really women, young people, men and women and children presenting themselves to seek asylum at the southern border. Those are refugees. And so we now have no distinction coming out of the rhetoric of our government between migration of any kind, whether it be on the basis of economics or on the basis of protected grounds. And it's all being demonized in the very same way.
And then the other thing I would add is you see where this administration is trying to go. If you've seen Secretary Nielsen testify at all, she is constantly talking about the need for Congress to, quote unquote, close loopholes. And when she says that, she is referring to the asylum system. She thinks basically the entire asylum system is a loophole and that it needs to be closed. It's very clear where DHS thinks they're trying to go. ICE many times thinks that people in detention who express fear have been coached or they've been told what to say. So how ICE is doing? ICE is doing very poorly, and they constantly look for ways to make sure that people are not identified as asylum seekers, and they want to make it harder. And they're looking for ways to make sure Congress can make their job easier in doing that.
I just think that it's worth noting that, I don't know if all the panelists are on the same, would agree with this, but I would say that I think it's actually one step even further than that. that like a couple of years ago, there was a deliberate blurring of whether or not people were economic migrants or maybe seeking family reunification versus had genuine protection claims. And this question, of, which is really one about fraud, right? Whether or not they've been coached, those claims were real. But the blur was economic family reunification versus real refugee, right? And for folks on the phone, there were a lot of hand quotation marks involved in that sentence. But we're actually already in a different place, which is actually much more dangerous, where the blur isn't between economic migrant and refugee, or saying this individual who's standing here, who's seeking protection from violence in Honduras, for example, is not a real refugee. There's actually an aggressive assertion that that person themselves is a criminal who's committed a criminal act, either by illegal migration, by smuggling, if they were complicit in bringing their own child, or in gang activity. A lot of the whole narrative about MS-13 and gang activity in general is actually about criminalizing people that not that long ago were collectively being referred to as potential asylum seekers. And so I would say that it's not even that those two categories have been blurred, but rather that this administration is moving in the direction of aggressively redefining them. And it's not about economic migrant versus refugee. It's about someone who they can pen a criminal conviction to or a pending criminal charge versus a refugee. And that's actually a much more dangerous place to be in. But naming the fact that this fits into a broader narrative of criminalization as well, I think is an important part of that answer.
Can I wholeheartedly agree, and then also refer everyone, if you haven't, to the report that Human Rights First just put out documenting the prosecutions of asylum seekers and noting in a connection back to the previous panel that, you know, what that looks like in practice now, according to Secretary Nielsen, right, is that if you have someone fleeing violence, presents themselves seeking protection on the border, gets prosecuted and convicted of unlawful reentry, then that person comes in, they're now within that 92% that Secretary Nielsen calls a criminal as someone who is now within DHS's enforcement priorities and they're bragging about in their statistics.
I think on that note, we have just about hit our time. I know it's a nice note to end on, but I do want to thank the panel. Everyone was great. So thank you. Thank you all for coming and thank you to our presenters.
Please grab some of the documents on your way out if you didn't get a chance to. There are a number of reports and fact sheets that different organizations have compiled and have offered up.
Just tell the folks on the phone we're going to end it.
Thanks to the folks on the phone.